If you are planning to pull your money out of a big bad bank and put your money into a credit union or community bank, well, you may be a neo-Jacksonian anti-mercantilist and not even know it. That, politics and pizza, and a conspiracy of men doing a good deed in this Hodge podcast based on listener questions and topics of the day. Andrew Jackson was a bit of an anti-bank politician. His allies in Tennessee actually threw out the government of John Overton, the governor and owner of the state's two banks. He was the leader of the Nashville Junto, and that controlled politics since the founding of the state. But after 1819, when a panic occurred in the United States caused by an inflation of bank and paper money, banks were persona non grata, or persona corporata non grata. In the United States, one of Andrew Jackson's militia buddies, William Carroll, defeated Overton, became governor of Tennessee, and passed laws limiting the issuance of bank money. This pleased the general. And when General Jackson became President Jackson, the United States had a national bank. The Bank of the United States, located in Philadelphia and headed by Nicholas Biddle. This bank had an advantage over all others. It received the tax revenues of the United States. In turn, it lent out money to foster commerce and make infrastructure projects possible. It also regulated the other banks in the country, because this was the place that all of the other banks in the nation sought money from. This was a source of criticism. An unelected entity with its neoclassical pillared stone building in Philadelphia, issuing too many funds in the boom times, and then tightly controlling it when people needed help. Biddle was no Bernanke, no Alan Greenspan. Only interested in banking, Biddle was a supporter of the National Republicans, soon to become Whigs, who wanted Jackson out of the White House. The bank had a 20-year charter, and it should have come up in 1836. There is nothing Jackson could do about that, though he might like to. But Biddle decided to have his allies in Congress push through an early recharter bill so that it would put the issue of the bank directly on the table and caused trouble for Jackson during his re-election. The same time, Biddle felt Jackson wouldn't dare veto this bank that was helping the economy. He would be forced to renew. Instead, Jackson vetoed, and in a veto message he said, "This bank itself has become a government, preventing the freedom of its citizens." Yes, indeed, folks. Andy Jackson was part of the 99%. Biddle called his message a manifesto of anarchy. But the public sided with the president. Congress didn't override, and the bank remained unchartered. Well, nothing happened initially. The real effect was that Jackson could now stop handing over the tax revenue of the United States to the bank and could eventually remove U.S. funds from the bank's vaults. His first Treasury Secretary refused to do it. It was too jarring. And then a second Treasury Secretary wouldn't do it either. So Jackson replaced him too and then appointed his friend Roger Taney. Taney ordered the money out of the Bank of the United States vaults, and future deposits would then be put into 8 state banks. These state banks were called pet banks by opponents because they were made up. 7 out of 8 of these banks had been Jackson supporters. Biddle took revenge. He ordered a contraction of loans throughout the branches of the Bank of the United States throughout the country. This had an effect on all the state banks in the nation. It had an immediate economic effect. And in 1833, this caused severe economic problems. Meanwhile, the pet banks couldn't get money out fast enough to replace this contraction. And even these pet pro-Jackson banks were getting money from the Bank of the United States, too. So even with the government money coming in, they had to contract loans as well. 1833 went into 1834, and even Jacksonians pleaded with the president to give in, just recharter the bank. Jackson told them again and again, "See Biddle. He has all the money lying in his vault." Jackson was censured by the Senate. Biddle suffered more, however, and his own investors eventually convinced him to continue loaning. And the House of Representatives subpoenaed his bank to investigate whether he had purposely started an economic ruin. A lot of fingers pointed at Biddle now. By 1834, the panic was ending. The Treasury now went beyond the 8 infamous pet banks and lent to about 91 banks around the country. Not all of them Jackson supporters now. The Bank of the United States did not completely end. It became the Bank of Pennsylvania and not an insignificant bank. But federal funds would no longer be deposited there. And up until the Federal Reserve was created in the 19-teens, we had no single national bank. Banks were regulated by the federal government, of course, but no single bank. Indeed, even the Fed legislation was careful to spread Federal Reserve banks all over the country. That was one of the requirements of the legislation. And although the Bank of New York is the most powerful, it remains the case today that there are Federal Reserve banks all around the country. Now, I don't dare compare the simple banking of 1833 to the complex banking of 2011, but it would be interesting to see if a movement succeeds in transferring money to smaller banks and credit unions, now flush with cash. What would they do? Can they handle it? And what would the economy look like? In 1950, a Mormon businessman named Evan Meekum made a choice. He left Utah, left college early, to start a car dealership, Meekum Pontiac Dodge, on a highway in Arizona. He was a good car salesman, did well. He bought a newspaper and a mining company. For decades, he was on local TV saying, "If you can't deal with Meekum, you just can't deal." He also ran for office in Arizona, mostly against Republicans in primaries. He wanted the U.S. out of the U.N. and for school prayer to be permitted all over the country. 5 times he ran for governor of Arizona, and finally, in 1986, he won the Republican nomination, beating the favorite of the establishment Republicans in Arizona, of John McCain and Barry Goldwater. He won the general election with 40% of the vote. That year, the Democrats in Arizona split, and it was a 3-way race. In office, Meekum increased the speed limit to 65 miles per hour, and that was about the extent of his actions that were popular. He canceled Martin Luther King Day in Arizona, bringing a firestorm of national controversy. See, in a way, he had justification. The previous governor, Bruce Babbitt, had created the holiday by executive order and didn't go through the legislature, so even the courts invalidated the holiday. Now, Meekum could have just said that. We didn't have a holiday because it was created illegally. But he didn't do that. Meekum said, "King doesn't deserve a holiday." And it didn't stop there. When African-American civil rights leaders came to visit, he told them, "You folks don't need a holiday, you need a job." He squabbled with his own party's leader over the size of a tax cut and spending cuts. His vetoes were routinely overridden. His education secretary said a teacher could tell a student the world was flat if they wanted to. That got him some national press. He said the high divorce rate was caused by women working. And the Martin Luther King Day controversy brought national shame to the state. Stevie Wonder announced a boycott. U2 played at a concert raising money to impeach Meekum. Companies were under pressure not to move, not to have business conventions in Arizona. But Meekum was not deterred. He told a staffer that he ruled by divine right and didn't have to check with anyone's opinion. He had private investigators look for listening devices in his office and the governor's mansion. And in fact, an aide was injured looking for listening devices on his roof. I talk about Meekum because Mary Schumacher writes, "Bruce, Wisconsin Democrats have launched an effort to recall their governor. It would be interesting to know the drivers behind these efforts instead of waiting for the next election." Thanks, Mary, and it's a good question. This one suffers from a small sample size. As near as I can tell, as near as anybody seems to have written, there are just 2 governors recalled in history, 2 state governors. And Meekum wasn't even one of them. But that's a technicality. There was a recall election set to happen, and Meekum had little chance of remaining governor of Arizona. Then it was discovered that he failed to report a campaign loan and diverted state money to a car dealership. These were charges, at least. He was impeached by the House in Arizona. Voters never got the chance to throw him out. It is extraordinary not to wait for the next election after you've just elected a person governor. So I would say great shame upon the state, a very poor performance in office, bipartisan support for removal. That's the Meekum example. You had McCain and Goldwater, as well as then-Congressman, now-Senator John Kyle, turn against him and call for him to step down. And there were also 13 state legislatures, Republicans, that did so as well. The poor performance was something the voters couldn't wait till 1990 to deal with. The 2 other examples, you know Gray Davis. He was recalled in 2003 as governor of California, having just been reelected in 2002. perhaps the victim of energy price manipulation by Enron and others. He was blamed for the state's energy crisis, including high prices, high energy prices for the state, blackouts, and a poor economy certainly didn't help him. It was also a well-organized partisan campaign to do the recall effort, and they had a celebrity candidate who galvanized the opposition. Now, California law worked against Davis in a way that is probably not going to be present in Wisconsin or other places. There was a recall vote, then on the ballot, the governor was excluded from the choice of who you wanted. So while Meekum, if he got into a recall in Arizona, there would have been a recall vote to do a recall at all, and then he would have had a chance to run against someone. It looked like it was going to be a congressman, a very popular Republican congressman that he would run against. So he had at least a second election. Davis was recalled, and then he was out. That's the way California law worked. There was, do you want a recall, and then who do you want? And Davis was excluded from being one of the who do you want candidates. We never got a Davis versus Schwarzenegger campaign. The other example is Lynn Frazier, who was basically a socialist governor of North Dakota. He had, didn't call it that, but his policies were socialistic. He had nationalized the state flour mill and a state bank. That flour mill is still owned by the state today. But the economy was not doing so well in the early part of the 1920s, and there was a conservative groundswell of opposition to him in office, and that got him out. I don't know what will happen with Walker. It's a political issue, doesn't seem to be bipartisan support, and despite all the news coverage, you know, if you brought us back to earlier this year, focus of the whole country was just on Wisconsin, I'd say maybe the recall vote would be stronger. One thing that's clear, the opposition there is organized, so low sample size of these events happening in history, not much to say. We'll see what happens. It comes in a red box with white stripes and a transparent window. The toppings are under the cheese, and it has the power to change politics as we know it, perhaps. It's Godfather's Pizza, the company of one Herman Cain. Cain is the surprise frontrunner in the poll. CBS poll put him 4 points ahead of Mitt Romney for the Republican nomination. Solid conservative, Tea Party favorite. Part of his appeal is he's saying something definite. He has his 999 plan for taxation. It is rare for a fringe candidate, which arguably Cain was, to become the front runner. But this is also an odd election. There's been a lot of publicity early on for this campaign. Keep in mind, in 1988, there had just been a debate in October of 1987. So you've already had several debates and gotten to know the candidates very well, and campaigns have gone up and down. Candidates have risen and fallen in the polls, and at least one candidate has dropped out. But in terms of a fringe candidate with very little support in the establishment who did it, Jimmy Carter is that story. 1976, no one was talking about the one-term governor of Georgia until he snuck up and won Iowa's caucuses. Now what's going on here? I think to some extent Cain has benefited from the early collapse of Perry in the polls and Bachman, and the dislike of ultra-conservatives for Romney. It might turn out that, it seems, when support for one of the other candidates goes down, somebody whose first name is not Mitt seems to get that support. So that will be a problem for Romney down the road. Already, there are front-runner baggage problems that Cain has. He's anti-abortion, but told a radio talk show it was a family choice. He said he'd like to put a sign on the border fence, an electric fence that says, "This fence will kill you," in Spanish, and put alligators in a moat around it. He said it was just joking around. There's been a harassment allegation, and he says, "Bring me the accuser." And the inevitable poo-poos from the Washington elites. "You can't ad-lib your way to the nomination," Ed Rollins commented. And Karl Rove said that Cain was already beginning to slide in the polls. But what about Godfather's Pizza? Well, New York Magazine sent Scott Wiener, that is a man that runs a pizza tour in New York City, into one of these Godfather's locations to try the pizza. The company's humble pie, he said, exhibited gummy or undercooked dough. The crust had been cooked on a conveyor belt rather than a standard oven, so all the parts don't get cooked as well. But, he said, the sausage, with little hints of fennel, was tasty. I'm happy to get feedback, even where it's critical. Vicky writes, your Israeli podcast had a definite pro-Israeli bias, and you made no effort to obtain the Palestinian point of view. Very disappointing, Bruce. Well, to some extent, I'll just take the comment at face value and the criticism, invite other comment about those the series of three casts that we did. I do want to say that the goal of that series was America and Israel. So looking at the relationship between the presidents of the United States particularly and Israel in the context of President Obama's comments in May of this year, which were attacked by pro-Israeli groups and Republicans as throwing Israel under the bus. And I think what we learned during the series, in addition to a lot of other things, we just simply had to get into a lot of topics, is that it's pretty common for American presidents to push Israel into the peace process, maybe further than they want to go. It wasn't intending to be a podcast about the Israeli-Palestinian debate, but obviously we brought that up. I think we talked about the poverty in Gaza. We talked about the wall that the Israelis are building. Its own Supreme Court has criticized the settlements. We talked a bit about that, which are impeding the peace process and not condoned by any other nation, including the United States. We talked about Yitzhak Shamir and his going to Madrid under false pretenses, delaying while he would build more settlements. We talked about how Likud has stalled its peace plans. So I can probably admit to some natural American viewpoint in all this, but I don't really think it took strongly Israeli side. Yorktown, Saratoga, Cowpens, Trenton, Brandywine. These are American Revolutionary War battles that we remember. Savannah is not often one of them. Maybe because it was a defeat. But the defeats, like Brooklyn Heights, Manhattan, Brandywine, we remember those. This battle is not as well known. A lot of the Revolutionary War in the South is not as well known, but it goes somewhat in a way towards answering this question. Sumita Hudson writes on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics Facebook site, I've never understood why America is so anti-French. They helped us fight the British. Talking a bit about the Battle of Savannah helps to understand that the French helped us out in the Revolution, but in a particular way. And the relationship has been complicated since the founding of the nation. The British in 1779 failed to take Charleston, and 3,500 troops under Lieutenant Colonel Archibald Campbell went south and easily took Savannah, Georgia. At the same time, the French were now helping us in the Revolutionary War, and a fleet under Admiral Charles Hector Theodot, the Count d'Estaing, was to come to Chesapeake and bottle up the British fleet. He didn't arrive in time. Then he tried to get the British fleet in New York, and he was afraid he couldn't get his ships into the harbor and retreated. Then in Newport, Rhode Island, he failed to coordinate properly with the Americans on the land under John Sullivan, Nathaniel Greene, and the Marquis Lafayette. Each side, the Americans and the French, deployed their troops at different times. And there wasn't trust between the two teams. Then D'Estaing saw the British fleet arrive in Newport and went after it, and ended up getting scattered. Both fleets actually were scattered in a storm. Had there been better coordination, Newport could have been a big victory. So the Franco-American alliance started with a dud, and D'Estaing repaired to the French West Indies. Washington pleaded with him to come up north and help out, to help limit the freedom of the British to reinforce up and down the East Coast. And this is where the French assisted most in the Revolutionary War. It's unlikely the Americans could have prevailed in the Revolutionary War in the way we did, at least, without containing the British fleet, because the British could take whatever forces they have and move them up and down the East Coast, while Americans had to kind of anticipate where they would come and hopefully defend. So Washington's pleading with D'Estaing. D'Estaing himself is looking to build his reputation a bit and have a victory. So he sails his 33 warships to Savannah. This is not where Washington asked him to go, but this is where the British were. He achieved some surprise, but as he loaded his 4,000 troops to prepare to attack, he gave the British time to surrender. They took 24 hours, built up defenses, and then said no. D'Estaing's attack on him then ended up taking a month before it launched. And once he did attack Savannah, about 650 French died, along with 200 militia. Meanwhile, only 100 British were lost. D'Estaing didn't attack again. He wouldn't press the attack with those kind of losses. The battle also claimed a hero, Casimir Pulaski, who was leading a cavalry charge. This was huge for the French, a loss on our behalf. So Savannah is evidence for both sides of how much did the French help us during the Revolution. Incredible sacrifice in the Battle of Savannah. You'd be hard-pressed to find a country in America's history who put up that much proportional sacrifice. But it was not entirely unselfish, either. When the British invaded Virginia, there was a similar failure to hook up with the French fleet and create an amphibious assault. Really, until you get to Yorktown. Then, finally, everything works out. Until you get there, the pieces really didn't come together. So the French helped us out, no doubt, helped to keep the British busy. But it was not the form of help that Washington or the Continental Congress hoped for. It was a risk-adverse, in French interest type of help. Now, that's not the real reason that there's any anti-French sentiment in the United States today, but it does sort of explain the Revolutionary War and their role in it. Americans were big supporters of the French after the Revolutionary War, at least a certain group of Americans. One of the two political factions, the Jeffersonian Republicans, was a pro-French party. And Democrat-Republican clubs, which are all across the early nation, would feature French flags. And they wanted us to be more pro-French than pro-British. You know, it really wasn't the same France that helped us out. Indeed, some of the people who were the big helpers of Ben Franklin, thinking about Lavoisier, thinking about the mayor of Paris, Jean Bailly, they were the ones that helped us get an audience with the king of France. They met the guillotine. The Marquis Lafayette, who had helped us out in the Revolutionary War, barely escaped the guillotine. He had to flee the country, ended up in Austria, and ended up in prison there for a time. I suspect, however, that none of this really goes to answer the question, but it does kind of put it in a context that things haven't always been so chummy with the French. I think it's more modern issues that are at work here. The socialist government of Francis Mitterrand, criticism of American policy, Charles de Gaulle's attempt to create a separate French foreign policy to even try to deal directly with the Russians. I suppose there's some cultural reasons. The French invokes academic, intellectual things, so you know how America is with that. I think there is a thaw recently, you know, with the French helping in Libya, Afghanistan, and the Sarkozy presidency representing a more American-style government. So I think there's a thaw in relations recently, and there's not as much of it as, say, there was during the Iraq War. A railroad ticket agent, a hotel keeper, a bank clerk, and an undertaker are unlikely conspirators. Yet for 10 years, these men held a secret, the location of Abraham Lincoln's body. But this was no criminal conspiracy. The men, led by Lincoln's funeral custodian, John Carroll Power, did it to preserve Lincoln's memory. Wes Hoffer writes, "I watched a History Channel episode where there was an attempt to steal Lincoln's body, and the body was hidden for years." Yes, Wes, it's very true. I do enjoy the History Channel. I don't watch TV, but I do watch their DVDs. Sometimes they have a flair for the dramatic. But good stuff. It is very true, though the attempt never really got close, and the body never strayed far from where it was placed in 1865 and where it is now. A band of Chicago counterfeiters were incensed when their engraver, Ben Boyd, was sentenced to 10 years, so they came up with a plot. Steal Lincoln's body, and then ransom it for $200,000 and Boyd's release. For help, they hired a man named Len Swagels to assist with the grave robbing, which they had not done before. They were just counterfeiters. It would have been easy. There was very little security where Lincoln's body was, in the Oak Ridge Cemetery near Springfield, Illinois. There was a reason for this. After Lincoln's death, the town of Springfield suggested a grave near a railroad station where visitors could see. Springfield was looking for a tourist attraction. Mary Todd Lincoln said that she had heard Abraham Lincoln say once that he wanted a quiet resting place. "The immortal saver and martyr for freedom," she said, "will be at Oak Ridge. My determination is unalterable." Well, that did it. Lincoln was placed there. It's 2 miles from Springfield, though, and there is no guard at night. So it should have been very easy for this caper to be pulled off, except that they were the exact wrong people to do it. They were counterfeiters. At this time, there was no FBI. There was no federal law enforcement agency except for the Secret Service. And the Secret Service was not protecting presidents. The Secret Service was in the anti-counterfeit business. Well, one of the men they hired, Lynn Swagels, was an informant for the Secret Service. And he let the Chicago office know about the plan. They allowed them to go through with the plan, but then detectives were waiting for them at Lincoln's tomb when they tried to pull off the caper. They tried to do it on an election night when everyone would be preoccupied with the local election. Detectives were waiting for them. As it turned out, the men couldn't lift Lincoln's coffin. It was just about 500 pounds, and they fled, and they were arrested later. Power and others decided to move the coffin to an undisclosed location in order to protect it from thievery. 2 years later, they changed that location just to keep it secret. In reality, the former president was not far from the real tomb. 10 years later, they again moved the coffin to another secret location. This one was essentially to the basement of the tomb. In 1901, under instructions from Lincoln's son, Robert Lincoln, when there was a total reconstruction of the monument and the tomb where Abraham Lincoln was in Oak Ridge, Lincoln was put into a steel cage and embedded in 10 feet of concrete so no one could ever steal the body. Just to be sure, before Lincoln was buried again, 23 witnesses checked and confirmed that Abraham Lincoln was still in the coffin. I want to thank you for listening. We do have a Facebook site. If you go to myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com, you'll get to it, or you can run a search on. There's a thread where some of the listeners are posting books that they have read. We got about 30 good book suggestions there. I'll let you know about the archive, 1499. It has just about everything that we've recorded. MyHistoryCanBeatUpYourPolitics.com. And if you do like the program, please tell someone about it. Thanks for listening.